As we continue to navigate these unprecedented times, KCBS is looking for answers to your questions about the coronavirus pandemic. Each weekday morning at 9:20, we're doing an Ask an Expert segment each day, trying to focus on a little bit different piece of the big picture. Today, we're going to look at the trends that are in play right now, the latest data, any worries you may have about the disease and its transmission. We are joined live on the KCBS Ring Central Newsline by UC San Francisco infectious disease specialist, Dr. Peter Chin Hong. Dr. Chin Hong, thanks for joining us again. How have you been?
I've been great. Always a pleasure.
All right. Well, you know, we have so many questions. I want to get right to them. I did want to get your take, if you don't mind, real quickly on this paper out of King's College London, where they looked at about 1,600 patients who were, I guess, logging their symptoms into a tracker app and have decided there maybe are sort of six different versions, six clusters of symptoms around COVID-19. Have you had a chance to look at that yet?
I haven't seen the King's College paper about that. Of course, King's College got in the headlines for another reason, which is about antibody levels, but definitely have a good sense about, you know, symptoms in the patients that we're seeing in general.
Well, so what they've done is, what makes this disease tricky is it seems to be, you know, many diseases in one. You get a flu-like with no fever, flu-like with fever, gastrointestinal, severe level one fatigue, severe level two confusion, where you literally are having mental issues, and an abdominal and respiratory severe level three. And the list of symptoms on that one seems to cover every symptom known to man. And you must have seen all of these, I guess.
Yeah, definitely. And I think this kind of work could be confusing to the community because it seems like anything you have could be COVID, which leads me to think about two main points, which is, first of all, testing should be free and widely available to anybody anytime they want. In that case, we wouldn't have to fuss around sort of like hemming and hawing about and worrying whether or not this might be COVID, maybe that might be COVID, and exposing potentially close family in our family, you know, family members in our household. The second point I would say is that of all these different shades of disease symptoms, there are probably some that are still very core, and that's the ones that we thought about at the beginning of the epidemic, which is, you know, wake up in the morning, you check to see if you have a fever, and you smell your coffee. If you don't have a fever and you can still smell your coffee, I think you're kind of good to go. And then the rest of it, you can kind of talk to your advice nurse or your primary care physician about it.
And for those who drink coffee, maybe make some toast.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, let's get to the questions. And again, ask us at kcbsradio.com is the email inbox. First question, given the increasing evidence on airborne/aerosol transmission, what do you recommend in terms of masks or face coverings, particularly for exercises such as cyclists who are traveling quite quickly, may not be able to distance sufficiently from other unmasked exercisers due to narrow bike lanes, et cetera?
Yeah, so my response to that is that although there's been a lot of hoopla around aerosol transmission, it still probably isn't the biggest effect or the biggest way that COVID gets around in the community. For the example of the cyclists, you're moving fast, you're outdoors, there's a lot of air turbulence. It will be extremely unlikely to transmit infection that way, unless the cyclist is going around you in circles and then shouting and screaming at you at all the time while doing that.
Well, let me ask you personally then, because there's a lot of consternation around this. Should these local mask orders be more specific and exclude the scenario we just talked about, two people out riding bikes quickly on the road?
I think when you give a lot of exceptions to public sort of guidance, it gets confusing to people. But yes, I mean, I think if you say a simple message like we really want masks, which is what I think we're still trying to do, and then maybe you can have some nuance around it, that might be okay. But I'm worried that if I given like 10 exclusions to masks, that people might be a little bit confused as to what they should or shouldn't do.
Okay. Next question. Is there any reason why, practically speaking, the United States cannot repurpose factories and materials and make N95 masks for every man, woman, and child and then insist that people wear them?
I love the idea of repurposing local factories to do protection for the community. I mean, we did that in war times, and they've been doing that actually for face shields. For a while, we were short of face shields in the healthcare field, and we talked about 3D printing and all that got a lot of attention. But what happened was a very interesting thing. A lot of plastics companies that make like water bottles and so on diverted their production lines to making face shields for healthcare providers. And that was a remarkable sort of intervention because it was cheap, it was high quality because they were used to doing quality control. And I just haven't seen the same with face masks. I would love if that happened. I know there was a lot of talk initially about 3M sort of like making millions for the people, but then that sort of died down. And I think ultimately what we need is a national distribution of masks that are free for everyone. Like in Toronto, they give out masks in the public transit. In Taiwan, every single person gets a face mask for free from the government. So I think that kind of public benefit that's free and widely available will increase people's use of this intervention that's so cheap and so easy in terms of protecting each other.
Next question. I have a friend who says she will not return back to cutting hair due to her belief that COVID-19 spreads like glitter. She believes the virus is potentially in everyone's hair, which she is cutting, exposing herself, her salon floor, and everywhere else, a concern for cleaning. Is this a valid concern as long as both hair cutter and client are wearing masks? Can she catch COVID-19 from cutting hair and or touching the skin on the head, back of the neck? Is this virus like glitter all over one's hair, skin, and clothes? Would it be safer to cut hair outdoors, minimizing the risk?
That's a great question. I would bring that question back to the basics of how we protect ourselves. And again, like I mentioned in the last time we talked, Stan, it boils down to the three W's. You wear a mask, you wash your hands, and you watch your distance. Of course, in a hair-cutting environment, you can't really watch your distance. But wearing the mask is the most important thing, and then washing your hands. And then you don't worry about surfaces because the surface could be bad and full of virus. But if you wash your hands, your hands are like the muni that transfers the virus from a surface to your nose or your mouth where the virus is trying to get to. So if you wash your hands often, it doesn't matter how many surfaces are contaminated. I come back to that really cool example in Missouri when these two hairstylists had COVID-19, like full-blown COVID. They were actually symptomatic. Everyone was wearing a mask, and of 139 people who were exposed to these hairstylists, you know how many of them got COVID?
I do know the answer to this one. And it's still a stunning, I mean, and now this is actually, at first this sounded like anecdotal and it made the local news. This has been run down. It's in a peer-reviewed paper. So the answer is zero, right?
Yeah, zero. And it's not just the hairstylist example. There are numerous other examples of in closed environments when people wear masks, there doesn't seem to be a lot of transmission. So the surface and fumite stuff, it's definitely great to add additional protection. But again, the virus is just trying to jump from somebody's nose or mouth to somebody else's nose or mouth. So if you wear a face covering, it really gives you the most protection. And if you wash your hands, it just adds that protection up a little bit, but the face covering is definitely the most important thing.
Next question. I've heard rumors that hospitals get paid 3 to 4 times more for COVID-19 deaths than other deaths. Thus, COVID deaths are inflated. Is this true?
Not that I know of. I actually think it's the opposite. We probably underestimated COVID deaths, and the reason is that, comes back to that first question you asked me, there's a wide range of symptoms that people have, and the more we go along in this pandemic, the more we're understanding that it's quite diverse. And a lot of people die at home, and particularly early on in these surge cities, like in the tri-state area, and they didn't know they had COVID, and nobody knew they had COVID, and those deaths weren't counted. The second thing is, of course, we had a delay in diagnostic testing in the United States, so a lot of people probably had COVID because we knew it was circulating in the community before we actually had the test to diagnose it. We still have a shortage of tests. So I think it's actually the opposite, and it, you know, probably doesn't have to do as much with payments as to lack of diagnostic testing and lack of appreciation of the wide range of symptoms that people may have while having COVID.
Okay, next question. How long should we wait for the air to be safe in an average one-story home when there have been people, residents or visitors, without masks for a day, or house cleaners who may not have been wearing masks while working? Can we just open lots of windows for a couple of hours?
There is some evidence from the lab that COVID, it depends on a bunch of different factors. One interesting factor with indoor situations is the amount of air exchanges you have. So if in a hospital setting, for example, there's really good air exchange because the hospitals were made to code with that in mind, but there's a wide range in the community. So if your particular room is cramped, there's not a lot of ventilation, the air exchanges are not that frequent, then you probably need to wait a little bit longer and sort of like a half a day, a few hours. To be conservative, 1 day is okay, like in terms of, you know, going into an Airbnb that somebody else has stayed in before. But, you know, if the air exchange is good, if there's good ventilation, you open the windows, and again, clean the surfaces. But if you wash your hands, again, that, you know, you don't have to go crazy. It would be okay.
Okay. Next question. Would your guest please comment on the presence of enanthem? I think we're talking about cavity lesions, right, in the mouth, as an early clue to diagnosis of COVID.
Not a very prominent indication, but again, I'm completely humbled by this disease. So again, as we learn more, we'll understand the role of rashes and COVID-19. The biggest sort of like signal for rashes are not the enanthems, it's more of the potential exanthems, which are the stuff you see on the outside skin, particularly the rashes around the toes that people talked about. And even with that, they haven't found evidence of COVID in all of these, you know, examples of the sort of COVID toes that we've been talking about, you know, a few months ago. So I think the answer is not a big prominent sign, probably more prominent with other diseases. So I'd worry about other infections like hand, foot, and mouth disease, other kinds of diseases before COVID. But again, I'm completely humbled by COVID every single time. So open mind is the axiom that I take with me.
Okay, well, here's another one that's probably right down that alley. This one says, let's say that one sibling or child who lives without physical contact in another state gets COVID, moderate to severe. Does that mean it's much more likely one will get a similar moderate to bad reaction if oneself is infected? That is, what is the heritability of poor reactions to COVID, such as the genetic component in one's response?
That's a great, great question. We don't have a lot of information about genetics yet. Right now, we think it's still old-fashioned. Like, regardless of genetics, it jumps from somebody's nose and mouth to the other nose and mouth. It's kind of an equal opportunity virus. But there's some intriguing evidence that there is some genetics, and even, you know, gender might play a role. So in terms of the genetics, the information comes from blood type and COVID. Blood type O has fewer proteins on the blood surface of the cell, so it kind of like is less, your body is less reactive to it. So those people tend to have more protection when you look at large studies. And on the other side, blood type A has a little bit more a protein that sort of stimulates the immune system. As you know, that it's the inflammatory response that makes people feel bad and get more severe disease. So those people tend to have a little bit more severe disease. It's really debatable how blood type O and A differ. It's seen in other infections, not just COVID, so there must be something going on there. As to the effect, it's probably not that huge, but it is something to make you think that there might be a small genetic contribution. But I think overall, if I had to pick one thing, it would be more environmental rather than genetic.
Okay. Major League Baseball's Florida Marlins with the COVID-19 outbreak. We've been reporting on that this morning. Difficult to have mask wearing and social distancing consistently. 50-plus players and support staff together. That would appear to be not all that different from a group of classrooms physically near each other in a school. The question is, can we learn anything from the Marlins situation about should we or how should we open schools?
Totally. I think the Marlins situation is extremely instructive, not just for the leagues of other sports to come. And the MLB has been extremely meticulous about playing this out. I mean, they've had like reams and reams of guidance, and they have done really innovative things like using saliva tests, doing frequent testing every couple of days. You know, I think it's a really good example of how to do stuff, but nevertheless, you're going to be at the mercy of the virus in the community. So first of all, the Marlins is based in Florida. Florida has a big surge. So if it was like a team in Hawaii, for example, probably going to be less of an issue, but it is a good example of what will happen in school. So even if you keep kids in pods, when one person is infected, the whole pod is going to be.
We lost you there. Tell you what, we may have just had a glitch. Fernie, would you mind seeing if you can reconnect with Dr. Chin Hong? It sounds like we may have just dropped out on our line between here and UC San Francisco. We'll sure try to get him back for at least the rest of that answer.
Yes.
Okay, thanks, Kim. We do have Dr. Peter Chin Hong back, and that's an answer that just didn't want to get out to the world, Doctor. I don't know.
I guess people, I think it didn't want to get out there because people are really hoping that the baseball team comes to, you know, works out, because I think we really need something like baseball.
Indeed.
Right now to make us feel better. So the bottom line is, if somebody's infected in a pod and a team is like a pod, we think about having pods in schools of students in small cohorts. But what will happen is that the entire pod or the group gets affected, even if you have no symptoms or you don't have infection, because from public health guidance, you have to stay isolated for 2 weeks. In schools, what would that mean? It means that even if you plan in-person activities, all of a sudden you'd have to be flexible because that class or that group will be at home, so you may have to convert quickly to online.
Okay. Next one. I now have 9 workers who've tested positive on my construction site over the past 4 weeks. Some have had to wait up to 10 days for results, during which time multiple people could have been exposed. At what point does the delay render the testing worthless? 7 days? 14 days?
Yeah, that's a great question and something that is completely frustrating. I would say that, yeah, it makes one of my colleagues says, the test becomes theater if you wait more than 7 to 14 days, because that's the time when you isolate or you quarantine anyway. So, like, you would develop symptoms of disease after incubation that period of time. So it just becomes like a theatrics when you wait 7 to 14 days for a test. But I would still do it. I think people are trying to make these test delays less prominent, and by doing a bunch of different things like pooling tests, by, you know, having tests run in different, more convenient sites. But we need to do better in the U.S. with testing.
This question, if a baseball player tests positive, won't the entire team have to go into quarantine for 14 days?
Yes, the entire team should go into quarantine. That's why I think it's a domino effect. And also the teams that have interacted with that team before, even if they have no symptoms. So it affects more people than the people who are infected. But I think what's happening in MLB is that they've developed this alternate list of people who can play. So they just go down the list, but at some point the list might run dry, and I'm really crossing my fingers that doesn't happen.
Okay, let's see if we can get a couple more in, then I'll let you go. This one, I'm over 65, undergoing chemotherapy for cancer and previously received a solid organ transplant. Will it be safe for me to get the SARS-CoV vaccine? I guess I have to say this out loud. The COVID vaccine as soon as it is available. Thank you.
Yes. I mean, I think that most of the vaccine candidates I've seen being tested are safe in people with compromised immune systems. And personally, I think that, immunocompromised patients, elderly patients should be one of the first group to get the vaccine because of all the reasons that we know about increased mortality, more vulnerable. So I think I would prioritize that group to get vaccinated.
All right. I have one here. Being inside since early March, I've been ordering food online from Amazon, et cetera. How is eating the processed, packaged tuna, chicken, crackers, canned foods, et cetera, and trying to make sure they have nutrients and are not junk without going out to get fresh fruit, veggies, and dairy affecting me? I'm in my late 70s in good health with glaucoma. Really afraid to go out and even to have stuff delivered from grocery stores. I even let my Amazon order sit for a few days before opening.
I would say that it's completely understandable to feel worried about it, but I would say that, in the cases I've seen come into the hospital, usually they have a very defined risk, like being exposed at close quarters, not wearing a mask, all of those things. So I would say go for the biggest bang for your buck, which is to wear a mask. Go at a period of time when a lot of people are not out. I know a lot of groceries are reserving the first hour for people like the person who called, where it's less crowded. There's not going to be other people allowed in. Also, you can like have fresh vegetables delivered to your place as well. But I wouldn't necessarily wipe down the vegetables. Coming back to one of the same questions we had earlier, the biggest bang for your buck is washing your hands and not worrying too much about ingesting the virus.
Okay, and I got one more. I apologize. There's so many of them coming in, we're going to run out of time anyway. But this one, could secondhand smoke transmit the coronavirus?
That's a great question. It probably wouldn't transmit the virus, but if somebody's blowing smoke, you can imagine the virus can travel a little bit further. But every time it travels further, the concentration of virus drops off. Smoke is also interesting because it's like pollution, and it may not necessarily increase your chances of getting it, but may increase the chances that it will progress because it kind of like stimulates your immune system a little bit more, like particulate matter and pollution.
All right. Well, thanks for taking the time, and as always, a pleasure to speak with you.
Always a pleasure, Stan. Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye. That's Dr. Peter Chin Hong, infectious disease specialist from UC San Francisco. And that wraps up this morning's Ask an Expert segment. We'll have it all wrapped up and made available online for you shortly at kcbsradio.com/askanexpert. Good place to remind you that if you use the radio.com app or the radio.com desktop login, you can follow the program and then immediately rewind live segments. You can go back over the last 24 hours to replay segments you heard on KCBS and forward them to friends and family, which is an excellent way to pass along the solid information from Ask an Expert.